Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie, brought to you by Killer Podcasts and Evergreen Podcasts Network. I'm the titular Sean.
And I'm the very titular Carrie.
It's the show that takes you inside the unbelievable, the unexplainable, the macabre, and the bizarre and tries to find an answer. Hello, Caroline.
Hi.
I promise, listener, next week we're going to be back in the studio, although we've had pretty good reviews on our audio quality from the bedroom here.
Yeah, sure.
On these podcasts, I want to be clear. There's no other recordings going on here. While we play the game of how many cans does it take to spray paint a ceiling?
A lot of cans.
We're here just one last week, and we're recording on a big historic anniversary, Carrie. Today is November 22nd, 2023, which makes it the 60th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination.
God, 60 years. That's crazy.
Our listeners may have, if you knew that, you may have checked into this feed this week expecting the beginning of a big multi-part series on the Kennedy assassination, the attending conspiracy theories.
Yeah, we just did so much Charles Manson. I feel like it's going to be a while till we do another big series like that.
A series that requires each of us to read several books. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Today, we're going to tackle a presidential assassination, but one with a lot less controversy and conspiracy attached to it, and probably the most obscure of presidential assassinations.
So enjoy, listeners.
I think they will. I think this is a really good story. But obviously it starts with, well, it ends with tragedy, really, sort of. But that's where we're going to start today. We're going to start with an ending.
Okay.
And Caroline, on July 2nd of 1881... James Garfield had to be feeling pretty good.
It wasn't a Monday, right?
No, that's true. It was a Saturday, everyone's favorite day of the week, I think.
Saturday.
And on July 2nd, Garfield was 4 months into his tenure as the 20th president of the United States. And while it was pretty early in the term, he was already elbow deep into it. He had proposed universal public education, and he was making plans to fight for that. He was refinancing the massive national debt that was still lingering from the Civil War, and he had started a campaign to root out the corruption at the heart of the postage system that was set to bring him up against many members of his own party. It was going to be a tough couple of years.
So we had to get rid of him, right?
But with the dog days of summer arriving in Washington in July, the federal government at this time basically shut down for the whole summer.
Mm-hmm.
And so Garfield, on July 2nd, was ready to settle into his first presidential summer vacation.
That sounds nice.
So he followed his two teenage sons, Harry and James, into the lobby of the Baltimore and Potomac Railway Station. The train there would take him to the friendly halls of Williams College, his alma mater, to give a speech before the old war hero retired to the Jersey Shore with his family for the summer break.
Now, just from context clues, I can tell what's about to happen, but even so, this seems like a very unsafe way for a president to get around.
At the time, apart from Lincoln during the Civil War, presidents didn't have bodyguards, there was no Secret Service detail, they just kind of were out and about.
Well, you would think after Lincoln,
you might
they would stick around a little bit.
You might think that, but once the war was over,
not even the theater was safe.
Yeah, that was, I think, it was seen as untoward, to have the president walking around with all these armed men, because the very suggestion that anyone would want to shoot the president was...
It had just already happened.
I know, just 16 years before.
So, that's the toward.
Well, at the time, he was accompanied only by his two teenage sons, the current Secretary of State, James Blaine, and the current Secretary of War. actually Abraham Lincoln's son, Robert Todd Lincoln. So,
Todd. He's, this poor man was traumatized.
It, both times in Washington, too. There was a loud bang from just behind the president. He felt hot pain in his shoulders and his arms flew up involuntarily as he yelled, "My God, what is that?"
Frazier?
He had just enough time to cry out, you know, that question before there was a second bang. And James Garfield collapsed in the train station as the beady-eyed man in the threadbare suit was already making his way to the door.
So where was he shot? Both times in the back?
He was shot in the shoulder and then in the lower back. We'll get more into Garfield's injuries later. But for now, don't you want to know who that beady-eyed little man was, Carrie?
Sure, yeah.
That would be Charles Guiteau, the most obscure presidential assassin in American history.
Another beady-eyed Charles, huh?
And probably the funniest one, if I had to. Well, I'll let you be the judge. Let's take a look at Charles's life. He was born September 8th, 1841, in Freeport, Illinois. He was the fourth out of six children of Luther and Jane Guiteau. But Jane died when he was just six or seven, and so Charles was mostly raised by his father, and Luther was a strictly religious guy. Who often beat his son pretty brutally for both his perceived sins and also as Charles began to grow up a nervous, awkward boy with a stammer, his father would brutally beat him to try to correct that as well.
Yeah, I've heard you can beat the stammer out of someone.
Yeah, that always helps, for sure. If every time someone stutters, you punch them in the face.
Yeah, make them more nervous and anxious.
Yeah, no, that's going to help. It did not. He was not a good speaker for his whole life, although we'll get to more of that later. Guiteau had dark hair that he always kept combed straight back, and that hair began to recede early as he aged. He had a big nose and small, piercing eyes that, look, he was never a hit with the ladies, I guess is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
His family didn't have a lot of money, but Charles would inherit about $1,000 when his grandfather died, and he decided to use that to go to college, make something of himself. But he flunked the entrance exams for the University of Michigan. And then he took, they had cram school at the time where, okay, if you fail a college exam, you can take courses, intensive courses in just a couple of subjects.
Mm-hmm.
So he went to cram in French and algebra so he could retake the test. He was getting supportive letters from his dad throughout this process. The dad was involved, but, Charles ended up quitting the program before he graduated. He didn't ever retake that university exam. And instead he went and joined the Oneida community.
What's that?
This is a utopian religious commune that was founded in 1848 by this reverend named John Humphrey Noyes, and it was near Oneida, New York, which is why it's called that.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a branch commune at the time in Waterbury, Connecticut, not too far from us, that would actually flourish until about 1878. Noyes believed that Jesus had already come back. About 70 AD. So he didn't wait long after the crucifixion.
Yeah, got an itchy trigger finger there.
And so therefore, all the things the Bible was talking about creating a heaven on earth, a sinless kingdom of heaven here on the earth, what are the rest of you waiting for? Jesus already came back. We can do this now.
Well, what proof did he have that Jesus had come back?
He would, like a lot of these guys do, point to a couple of different scriptural passages and say, and this clearly means... So by the time Charles Guiteau joined in 1860, there were probably 250 to 300 people living on this little commune, and they farmed their own food, and they also, for a little extra community money, they crafted leather bags, wove straw hats, and they built furniture and animal traps. In the 1870s, you know, after Charles left, the commune would start manufacturing silverware. And 140 years today, 140 years after the Oneida community fell apart, Oneida Limited is still one of the largest silverware manufacturers in the world. So that all grew out of this like kind of weird religious commune. Now, Noyes, this is the interesting thing about them. It's not the silverware. Noyes supposedly coined the term free love.
Oh, was that, but did it mean?
Yes.
Oh.
The members of the Oneida community were engaged in what he called a complex marriage, where they were all married to one another and everyone was free to have sex with everybody else.
Okay.
Noyes himself, as is often the case in these kind of culty situations, Noyes himself would often guide, you know, who coupled up with who.
They always do that. Yeah. So it's free love with limitations.
No, you can have sex with anyone you want to, but please don't impregnate anyone who Noyes doesn't approve.
Okay.
They were big on male continence, which is a fancy term for just holding it back.
Oh.
I know, it doesn't sound like the best form of birth control, but apparently there were only 12 unplanned births in this commune between 1848 and 1868, which is not bad for a 20-year span of, I guess, just orgies.
I guess, yeah.
Now, women over 40, middle-aged women who were unlikely to bear kids at this point, were often paired up with the younger men to help teach them that kind of self-control thing, and also train them in the arts of love.
Okay.
So all of this probably sounded great to the young, large, schnozzed Charles
Guiteau. He loves a MILF.
Well, it's just like maybe this is the only chance he has, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But despite even this, you know, kind of cult's free love leanings, everybody has sex all the time, nobody wanted to have sex with Charles Guiteau.
That must have hurt.
He was generally rejected and lonely over the 5 years that he stayed on this commune. And the women of the Oneidans pretty quickly started calling him Charles Get Out.
No.
And so that was what people would kind of whisper as he was going around.
The library is open.
This is especially sad because Guiteau, who we'll see is kind of a lifetime joiner, like a cause or an organization goes by and he's like, yeah, me too. He seems to have worshipped Noyes and once wrote that Guiteau had, quote, perfect, entire, and absolute confidence in him in all things.
Hmm.
And now, to be fair, with the, you know, they're treating Charles pretty mean, right?
Yeah.
But to be fair, within a few weeks of coming to live on the commune, he started chafing under this expectation that everyone pitches in on the manual labor around the farm. And Charles apparently sent Reverend Noyes a note saying, like, basically, I was chosen by God personally to come here and help you because of all my undiscovered talents, so it's not really fair that I should have to do work that I don't want to do.
I just wanted the MILFs, not the manual labor.
Exactly, right. The Oneidans had, and this reminds me of, I think this was a thing in, like, Jonestown.
Mm-hmm.
The Oneidans would have big community meetings where everybody was free to single out any other member of the community.
Well, that's a pretty, I mean, I guess depending on the cult, but if you're talking like a classic religious cult, that's pretty usual thing that you'll see.
Well, it sounds like basically every week these meetings were just everyone piling on Charles.
Oh.
Like just, he's an egotist, he doesn't care about anyone else, he only cares about himself, he doesn't help out around the farm.
Listen, I know I shouldn't feel bad about him, or for him, because of what he would end up doing, and I'm sure he was insufferable, but this doesn't make things better. This is not going to help him be a part of society more.
In other people's descriptions of Charles Guiteau, it is shocking and sad and hilarious how often the word annoying comes up. Everyone was immediately wanted to get out of his presence as soon as he was around.
Wow.
So after nearly 6 years of rejection on the commune, Guiteau left. Obviously, this communal living thing wasn't working out for him, but maybe he could help and spread Noyes' good word in some other way. So he moved to Hoboken, New Jersey, and he started a religious newspaper based on Oneidan teachings, and it was called The New Theocrat. And I don't know, I guess just running a newspaper was a lot more work than Charles thought.
Okay.
And within 4 months, the newspaper folded amid just a total lack of readership. I'm not sure how many issues he even published.
He didn't really seem to be one to want to do any work.
No, and that's, I think that's a common thread in people who end up becoming murderers when you look at more and more of their stories, like serial killers,
like
a lot of the
frustrated
time.
Idealism.
A lot of your serial murderers are like highly intelligent, but really lazy and feel above, like, you know, doing a real job.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't Guiteau's last brush with the Oneidans, although he would eventually cut ties with them completely. He came back to sue Noyes, his adopted father figure, essentially, for the 6 years of work he had supposedly performed on the commune's behalf.
But so, I thought he didn't want to do any work.
Right, but he claimed that he had done work that he didn't want to do, and now he was coming back to sue them for back wages. So he sued for like $9,000, which is, I don't know, like $170,000 today, something like that.
Right.
Guiteau's actual father was really embarrassed by this and wrote public letters like against his son backing Reverend Noyes. Like, you know, this is a frivolous lawsuit, et cetera, et cetera. Very embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
Years later, while Charles was on trial for killing the president, the Reverend Noyes would recall that he considered Charles irresponsible and insane.
He's insane, but even worse, he's irresponsible.
As well as, quote, moody, self-conceited, and unmanageable. He felt that Charles had contracted insanity via syphilis.
He did get banged.
Well, he wasn't a virgin at this point, and Noyes kind of, remember Noyes' whole thing is like, this is why we should all be living in a commune where we all have sex with each other. He just publicly, his public supposition was that Guiteau had frequented brothels and contracted syphilis and
gone
crazy.
Well, he was living in a commune, but no one would have sex with him, so it seems like this utopian ideal did not work for everyone.
Well, it certainly didn't work for Charles Guiteau, which is why he left. So what was next then? What was the next order of business? What could he turn his talents to?
Entertainment?
Maybe. Well, what about lawyering, Carrie? As it turns out, it was much easier to become a lawyer in the 19th century.
Yeah, I believe that.
So after he left Oneida for good, Charles Guiteau went and got a job at a law firm in Chicago, just as a clerk. And then he just took the bar exam. Apparently it was a pretty cursory exam at the time. And he passed and was admitted to the bar in Chicago in 1868 in the summer.
So vague Ted Bundy vibes here.
Yeah, although I picture Ted Bundy probably, he didn't get, I don't think he ever got to argue cases in court except for his own.
Yes, spoiler alert.
But he probably, I mean, the judge in that case said he would have made a good lawyer. Charles Guiteau was not a good lawyer.
Yeah.
And apparently he mostly subsisted on making bill collections. There's only evidence that he argued an actual case in court one time, which he apparently lost.
Mm.
And these quotes are both from Charles Guiteau, his infamous life. One lawyer recalled that Guiteau had to defend a man accused of petty larceny. And though the case seemed too plain for argument, he indulged in a long and rambling speech into which he introduced theology, divinity, and the rights of man.
My record's 100%.
Wins or losses, sir.
It's 100%.
From another account, the style of the plea and his conduct during its delivery were such as to convince all the lawyers who were present that he was a monomaniac. His talk was senseless and grotesque, as all his talk has been ever since he came before the public, and the whole speech in its manner was adapted best of all to injure his client, was indeed the speech of a lunatic. The manner was even worse than the matter. He talked and acted like a crazy man. There was a bar between him and the jury. He came up to this bar, jumped over it like a monkey, put his fist in the face of a juryman, and talked with great vehemence to the amusement of the spectators, and his client was convicted without the jury leaving their seats.
Is a monomaniac like a narcissist?
Yeah, like a megalomaniac.
So this is like if Charles Manson was able to represent himself or whatever and pass the bar exam.
You know, hey, exhibit A. Look at this. Mr. Manson, is that feces?
Made it myself.
Yeah, I like it. Guiteau would meet and marry librarian Annie Bunn in 1869. So he did, you know, he was successful in love for a brief window of time anyway. Ex-wife Bunn would later reveal that Guiteau was almost always skimming on his bill collections. Remember, he was mostly making his money just collecting bills for people, and he was just always holding money back from those.
Do we know anything about this relationship, like how they got together?
I don't know how they met or got together, but I know Guiteau and Bunn would both later regret this marriage.
Oh.
Guiteau said he couldn't find anything, any fault in her conduct, but, quote, she just didn't suit me. He expressed this apparently by being physically abusive and sometimes locking her in the closet for hours.
Jesus.
And when Annie said she wanted a divorce in 1874, that's, I think, 5 years after they got married, Charles said, that's fine, I'll help. And he went out and had sex with a prostitute, and then paid the prostitute to testify to his infidelity in court as grounds for the divorce.
Okay. Weird.
But before all that, before the marriage finally fell apart, in New York, Guiteau found a new love, and that was Democratic politics. Guiteau moved to New York during the presidential campaign of Horace Greeley, who was a New York newspaper magnate, and he was running against Ulysses S. Grant in 1872.
Now, is this Democrat as we vaguely know it today, or is this the kind of Lincoln was really a Republican sort of thing?
Lincoln was a Republican.
But that was more like a Democrat is now, right? Back then?
I think it's really hard to map this Democratic and Republican party.
Well, now it's psychotic, but...
Well, but even 10 years ago before our parties got really crazy, it is the Democratic and the Republican Party, and there's a through line, like those parties are the same organization, but the positions are completely...
Well, right. So what I'm saying is...
I wouldn't say opposite, though. I would say just they were arguing about different stuff that we don't have today.
Right.
But the Republicans were the abolitionist party. The Democrats' biggest power base was in the South, with all of the former slave owners who currently were going through... I mean, Reconstruction didn't go well. The ideal would have been for the South to be rebuilt after the war and also for rights to be extended to all black people in the South. Neither one of those things happened. So
were the Republicans at this time more socially liberal?
Well, I don't know if they would have even recognized those terms. The Republicans were definitely more about protecting the rights of black people in the South, but that was also kind of expiring as an issue that Northern Republicans cared about, because the Civil War was behind them.
Right.
And you couldn't shake a fist at those evil, you know, Southern...
Yeah, all that stuff just disappeared, right?
If you were a white person in the North, it did for you.
Yikes.
So, but that said, every election was basically run on the Civil War still.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of voters up North would vote Republican. A lot of voters down South would vote Democrat. And...
Sure, I mean, we've seen that with World War II, with 9/11.
Right. So the Civil War issues weren't the whole thing anymore, but they were definitely still casting a shadow. And in fact, the guy this Horace Greeley was running against was, of course, Ulysses S. Grant, the commander-in-chief of the Union Army. So it's still looming big in everybody's minds.
Mm-hmm.
Guiteau got behind Horace Greeley in a big way. And by that, I mean he wrote one speech once, which he delivered to a half-listening crowd in New York City. And Greeley would ultimately get stomped by Ulysses S. Grant, who again was a popular hero of the Civil War and cruised to his second term. He was also the incumbent. So Horace Greeley never had a chance in this race. But over the course of the campaign, Charles Guiteau convinced himself that if Greeley won, he would have to be very grateful for Guiteau's help, and he would probably appoint him minister to Chile.
Okay, so first of all, delusional.
Yes.
Second of all, why Chile?
It was just, he thought it would be a nice place to live, like, you know, warm, nice weather, not too much. By the way, a lot was happening there politically at the time, but maybe he just, so that would make it a better stepping stone to power, kind of. I know what you're thinking, Carrie. Charles Guiteau doesn't have any credentials to be a diplomat of any kind. He can't even talk to a person on the street.
Yeah, he's... What a strange person.
Well, U.S. politics at the time was governed by what they called the spoils system or the patronage system. Spoils as in to the victor go the spoils. Basically, when a new party came into power, and this is, I think, kind of how I don't live in the U.K. and I don't really know anything about their politics, but I think this is kind of how it works in the U.K., where the new government comes in and they just kind of, you know, the whole civil service apparatus was up for grabs. You would basically fire everyone the old party put in and put in all people you chose, and that usually meant allies, friends, family, people who had helped you in the political campaign. So it was graft, basically. It was like official graft.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very normal thing for things like cabinet positions and ambassadorships to be given to people who didn't necessarily have the credentials. I mean, think of the Trump cabinet. You know what I mean? People who didn't necessarily have the credentials, but were just had helped the person get into office.
So we're kind of expanding the swamp here.
This was a big issue for the Republicans at the time. There were kind of old school Republicans who wanted to keep this patronage system and the sort of new breed who wanted to, well, they were called the half-breeds, actually, who wanted to get rid of it.
Such nice, quaint names for things.
But with patronage, you know, being there, so Guiteau had good reason for thinking if he was a big, important ally of the president by giving this one speech, maybe he would get this cool appointment.
Okay.
But with Greeley's shattering loss, again, to Ulysses S. Grant, Guiteau somehow lost interest in politics.
Hmm.
Maybe this isn't for me.
Yeah, because it wasn't for him, literally. It wasn't in his interest.
That's right. And after his divorce in 1874, Charles stayed with his sister in Wisconsin for a while. Until one day in 1875, she said they were arguing in the driveway, and Charles angrily...
Well, I don't think so.
And he angrily threw some firewood to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
When his sister bent to pick up the firewood that Charles had dropped, she looked up to see him, with his eyes fixed on her, slowly raising the axe over his head. She dropped the wood, ran inside, and she was, you know, she was talking to doctors, she was talking to police, she was considering having Charles committed, but he snuck out of the house in the night and fled.
House guest from hell.
Yeah. Apparently, at this point, his father truly believed that Charles had been possessed by Satan.
Hmm. Yeah, maybe. he certainly sucked.
But Charles felt more like John the Baptist, I think. Because in 1877, after leaving his sister's house, he turned back to religion.
Sure.
And he would eventually distribute a self-published religious manual called The Truth, A Companion to the Bible. Which was mostly, I don't think you'll be surprised to hear, mostly plagiarized directly from the work of John Humphrey Noyes.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I started out kind of joking about the parallels to Manson, but there are definitely parallels. There's just the fact that he has a zero in charisma.
Yes, and Manson
has
like
a... somehow had a lot of charisma, at least if you knew him.
Yeah.
Or to some people. So he could never be like a cult leader type because he just had nothing there that people gravitated toward.
Even if you didn't like Manson, he opened his mouth and people just had to listen because of something magnetic about him. Charles is like the other pole of the magnet, where even if he was saying something really interesting, people would be fleeing.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, it must be difficult to be that kind of person. Well, I'm trying to be empathetic.
Picture that. Picture him, the guy we've established now. He publishes his religious manual, and then he spends 2 or 3 years as an itinerant preacher, just walking from town to town and lecturing in public places to just whoever.
Yeah, because
no one
wants him in private places.
Even the people who showed up to, like, sometimes he would post a bill, like, well, I'm going to be giving a talk here. And people would show up sometimes, not many, but most of them would leave before he finished speaking.
I mean, that kind of anti-charisma, it must be some sort of talent.
Well, yeah, I guess if you could find a way to harness
that. It's like
the
Zach Galifianakis character of Between Two Ferns, you know? I think that's sort of an anti-charisma.
Yeah. We have to find a way to harness this power.
I don't know.
Charles never did, spoiler alert. His next try was insurance sales. That didn't seem to go any better. And 6 months later, Charles Guiteau was racking up debts all over town in his current posting in Boston. And he was soon also wanted for theft.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it was this point, maybe it was when the charges came down, that he decided, I don't really have a passion for sales. And wouldn't you know it was an election year again, 1880.
So no more incumbent.
And Guiteau decided now was the perfect time to get into Republican politics.
Oh, flip-flop.
Well, he wasn't going to be on the losing side again, Carrie.
Mm-hmm.
President Rutherford B. Hayes... we've skipped a term here. So
oh, okay.
Grant was elected to a second term, then it was Rutherford Hayes. Rutherford B. Hayes didn't seek re-election in 1880, And the Republican Party was split between the, I mentioned there was kind of two factions. The old school stalwarts were supporting Ulysses S. Grant for a third term.
Oh.
And the new kind of liberalizing half-breeds, which is a name, the other side applied it to them, but they kind of liked it and kept it. It's like the Democratic symbol being a donkey, because Andrew Jackson liked that they were called jackasses.
Mm-hmm. It's like, well, we're going to jackass even harder now.
Yeah, exactly. So like I said, the split between, the half-breeds were supporting Maine Senator James G. Blaine, who was one of these kind of anti-patronage guys. Now, meanwhile, the favorite for the Democratic nomination was Winfield Scott Hancock. We'll talk about him in the general in a second. But Guiteau decided he was now a stalwart Republican, because they were the ones who wanted to keep giving away the kinds of jobs that he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wrote a big, rambling speech entitled Grant Against Hancock. That's the Democrat he was going to be running against. And jumped on the first ship to New York City.
New York City.
Guiteau's plan, at this point, Carrie, well, I don't know, what do you think he's going to get out of this? He's going to go deliver his speech and what?
Well, he's going to expect that he's going to get, you know, ambassador to fucking, I don't know, Russia or something. And he's not.
That's right. He's looking for a cherry appointment for himself after he helps Grant secure the nomination and the presidency. And so on June 11th of 1880, a foggy night, Guiteau was a passenger aboard the SS Stonington out of Boston, headed for New York so he could get his political career back on track. And at the mouth of the Connecticut River, the Stonington collided with the SS Narragansett. Stonington was able to limp to port and no one aboard was killed, but the Narragansett took on water fast through a big old gash in her hull, and then somehow caught fire and burned.
Oh, God.
Very quickly. Between 50 and 80 people died. And watching that wreck from the dock was Charles Guiteau, who now felt more sure than ever that he had been spared from death for some higher purpose.
Oh, boy.
And that purpose, he felt, had to be the election of President Grant to a third term. And then right after he got to New York, newly elected Senator James Garfield came out of left field to win the Republican nomination.
Wah, wah.
On the 36th ballot at a very contested convention. And we will, we haven't really met Garfield yet, so we'll introduce you to James Garfield and then get to that fateful day, or at least close to it. This is going to be a two-parter for sure, after the break.
All right.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
Welcome back. When last we left you, a little obscure guy named James Garfield, he wasn't that obscure, he had just been elected U.S. Senator, he had been a U.S. Representative.
Loved lasagna.
For a couple of years, he famously loved lasagna. but Garfield had just come out of nowhere to secure the Republican nomination in the 1880 presidential election, which was going to throw potentially a little wrench in the works for our friend Charles Guiteau. Of course, Guiteau had written his whole speech about supporting Grant for the nomination and in the election. And now Grant wasn't going to be running anymore.
G to G. So, just change a few words.
Well, we'll see what he does about that. But in the meantime, let's introduce you to James Garfield. Garfield was born November 19th, 1831, in a log cabin in Orange Township, Ohio, to his parents, Abram and Eliza Garfield. But Abram would die in 1833, when he was just 2 years old. So he grew up poor and fatherless, and young James was relentlessly bullied by his peers at school. He ended up leaving home at 16 to go and work on a canal boat in Cleveland. Because, wow. Like, he was just like, well, I'm done with this, you know, and I need to make some money for the family. And But he got sick about 6 months in, and while he was recuperating at home, his mom made him promise to do at least one more year at school. And school stuck this time around. He was a very talented student, and he would end up graduating from Williams College as the salutatorian, the second in his class. And this was when he went to college, Garfield, was right around the time that abolitionism, you know, pre-Civil War, was spreading like wildfire around northeastern college campuses. It was like the trendy student issue of the day in the North.
Mm-hmm.
And Garfield started considering a career in politics. All this excitement around abolitionism really inspired him.
Well, what, did he believe in abolitionism?
Yeah, strongly.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to, yeah, he was a pretty, he was on the bleeding edge liberal end of the Republican Party for sure. When he eventually got into politics.
Mm-hmm.
But first, after graduating, he spent a couple of years as a principal of a local college in Ohio. And then he was convinced to run for state senate in 1860. Something else happened in 1860, Carrie.
I can't think of anything.
The winner of the U.S. presidential election that year was another abolitionist Republican who had been born in a log cabin.
Who's that guy?
Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, after Lincoln was elected, South Carolina seceded from the Union on December 20th, and Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Texas, Virginia, Arkansas, Tennessee, and North Carolina would follow by May of 1861. And even before May, in April of 1861, the rebels bombarded Fort Sumter, and the American Civil War was off and running.
Mm-hmm.
Now, James Garfield, passionate abolitionist, major patriot, personally brave man, desperately wanted to get into the fighting ASAP. But the governor of Ohio convinced him he was more valuable for the time being in Congress and convinced him to serve out at least until the legislature got to their, I mentioned the federal government basically had a summer break.
Mm-hmm.
So he was like, until summertime, just stick it out. And Garfield helped appropriate the money to equip and train volunteer regiments from Ohio. And then in August, his homework was done, and he was commissioned as a colonel in the 42nd Ohio Infantry, which didn't exist yet. So also, James, can you find some soldiers for us?
Wow.
And he did, and many of the members of the 42nd Ohio Infantry were Garfield's friends, neighbors, and family from home, and also his former students from when he was at college.
So he must have really believed in this if he's putting everyone's life on the line, being like, you gotta fight in this war.
And it also tells you that he must have been beloved in his community and as a teacher.
Man, I'm feeling sad about this guy.
In the Midwestern theater of the war, where he spent most of the action, Garfield distinguished himself repeatedly throughout the fighting, including pulling Ulysses S. Grant's fat from the fire at the famous Battle of Shiloh. And he was promoted to brigadier general and then major general by the end of the war. So huge, huge war hero.
Mm-hmm.
And in the closing phases of the fighting, Garfield's political allies in Ohio, the same guys probably who had convinced him to run for state senator a couple years ago, encouraged him now to run for U.S. Congress. And he said, well, that's fine, but the fighting's not quite done yet, and I don't have time to campaign. So if you guys can just run it for me, whatever. So they campaigned for him while he kept doing army stuff. And he won without going home in October 1863 by a 2-1 margin.
Yeah, I mean, you know, campaigning on this guy is so devoted to his cause that he's not even here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty intense.
Lazy orange cat, he is not.
No.
James Garfield. So he sat down in Congress once the fighting was truly over as an abolitionist firebrand. And he spoke and voted in favor of, you know, punitive measures against the South. His version, a lot of very, you know, far Republicans, a lot of very abolitionist Republicans' idea of Reconstruction was like, well, we need to punish these guys and make sure this never happens again and make sure the black people in the South have rights now.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, again, the counterbalancing thing was, well, we don't want the South to be just a poor, broken mess forever.
Well, that's the thing, because obviously what they did was horrific and terrible and warranted punishment, but also you look at, I mean, this is after, but just for our purview, you look at World War One, and well, we did that to Germany and look what happened there. It caused this massive backlash. So you have to be balanced about these things, even if personally you might not feel that way.
Exactly right. But Garfield didn't feel that way. And
no.
he spoke voracious, like he spoke vociferously in favor of the federal government confiscating all lands that had been owned by slave owners and rebels. Like, this is just government land now. We'll decide what to do with it.
And I mean, personally, you might feel a certain way about that, but like, practically, that's just going to make them madder. That's just going to make them more resentful.
Well, he was also in favor of exiling or executing the major leaders of the rebellion. So,
yeah.
These were all things that Abraham Lincoln was not in favor of, and in fact had promised to veto if the members of his own party tried to do them.
Mm-hmm.
So throughout Reconstruction, Garfield, as I mentioned, he was also a major advocate for black suffrage, for black people getting the vote. And he tried to add more civil rights protections to the 18th Amendment, which freed black people from slavery officially, or outlawed slavery. Garfield's quote on this, because they weren't able to shoehorn any other civil rights protections in, and he said, "What is freedom? Is it the bare privilege of not being chained? If this is all, then freedom is a bitter mockery, a cruel delusion."
He seems like a pretty good guy.
He was, and in January 1880, he was elected to the U.S. Senate. This was, again, a thing where people tried to convince him. This was like a good stepping stone to the presidency kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he was elected to the U.S. Senate, which was the House of Representatives would elect the senators at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So he was elected to the Senate, but he never sat there because he was more or less accidentally nominated for president at the 1880 Republican National Convention before the next Senate could even start.
So how did that work?
So he showed up to support another guy. Remember, you had the stalwart Republicans backing Ulysses S. Grant for a third time,
mm-hmm.
and you had the half-breeds supporting James Blaine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Garfield showed up to support a third guy. You know, there were not one of the two favorites. There were other candidates in the wings, kind of, you know, vying for their hoping for a second ballot or something like that. And the guy he was supporting was one of the guys who had supported him for Senate. So it was kind of a you scratch my back, I scratch yours kind of thing. But through repeated votes, again, I think it was the 36th ballot that this thing finally got sealed up. So they were there like all night, right? Smoke-filled rooms, horse trading. And as the stalwarts and the half-breeds repeatedly, you know, were shouting each other down, almost coming to blows at times, some like really heated debates about how your side's all crooked and no, your side wants to tear the whole system down. And James Garfield was repeatedly the adult in the room. He would stand up and go, "No, guys, come on. That's not quite true." And so everybody just throughout this night, more and more
people were like, "Well, how about this guy? I like the cut of this guy's jib."
Exactly. And he was, since he was a little bit more on the liberalizing half-breed side,
mm-hmm.
Old stalwart Chester A. Arthur was placed on the ticket as the vice president. So there was a little bit of balance there.
The Lyndon Johnson.
Exactly right, Caroline. Oh, we will get to that Kennedy assassination podcast someday.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Now, Carrie, what do you think Charles Guiteau now did with his speech, Grant against Hancock?
I have no idea, because this guy just flip-flops as it suits him. So I know he's going to kill Garfield. It would be ironic if he campaigned for him, but this guy seems like he's not really playing with a full deck, so.
Well, a guy playing with a full deck might have written a new speech, but the best Charles Guiteau could do was go through the speech he'd already written and scratch out Grant's name and put in Garfield's name.
Yeah.
With basically no other changes.
Mm-hmm.
So like,
that's what I said that he would do, is just so every time there's a G.
So, like, the word stalwart shows up in the speech, even though it doesn't really apply to the candidate and all this stuff. August of 1880, Guiteau showed up at the Fifth Avenue Summit. And this was kind of like, okay, you've already had the Republican National Convention, but not everybody can make it to that one. So let's have another meeting now that we know who our candidate is, and all the Republicans will just talk about stuff. So this was the Fifth Avenue Summit, and it was in New York on Fifth Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And Guiteau showed up with his pamphlet in hand. and distributed it to anyone who would listen, and made repeated pleas.
Excuse me, I was hoping I could deliver this. Excuse me, I was hoping I could address the crowd.
Oh, God.
To the point of annoyance.
Yeah.
And eventually, he just desperately wanted to be allowed to speak at this gathering. And eventually, maybe more to shut him up than anything else, he was allowed to take the stage and read his pamphlet aloud in front of the assembled, you know, spectators, with James Garfield standing next to him.
Now, the thing is with this guy is that you can see the sort of roots of abuse and how they informed his actions, because he had problems speaking when he was younger, at least. He had a stammer, obviously very nervous when speaking, and to the point where his father would beat him whenever he spoke and stammered. So it's almost like he has this psychological need to be heard because he was always beaten down whenever he tried to be before.
Yeah, I think that's probably part of it. And also, I don't know, maybe it's not a surprise that a guy who struggled so much to speak early in his life would just never stop once he got the hang of it.
Exactly.
Whether he's good at it or not.
Yeah, it's sort of like James Earl Jones didn't speak until he was 5 years old or something, and then he became one of the most famous voices of all time.
Exactly. And as he's standing next to candidate Garfield delivering this speech, Charles Guiteau must have felt like he was closer to his dream of being handed a cushy government job for nothing than he ever had been before. For his part, James Garfield was still not interested in running a political campaign, so he largely left that part to the professionals, and he went to his home in Mentor, Ohio. He had bought a home there, big house, a couple of years ago. He had a big family that he needed room for. And so the press would soon come to call this house Lawnfield, and Lawnfield hosted what's considered the first successful front porch campaign in U.S. history. This is where, like, the candidate stays at home and everybody comes to him to hear his speeches.
That's how I would run. Just like, you know, you come to me.
This worked another couple of times in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And then, I mean, you would think television would have made it easy, but for some reason they've abandoned this and now they all, you know, descend en masse on Wisconsin and stuff.
New Hampshire. Would you ever run for political office? Maybe we should have talked about this before we got married.
No, I think in a lot of ways, it would be fun. It would be fun work being a politician, but I think it would be a bummer more of the time.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Yeah, I think I don't think I will now, but I think if my life had taken a different path, I could maybe see that being an interesting job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hmm. I have a lot of strong opinions.
Really? I've never noticed.
Though the election of 1880 started with the usual North versus South kind of post-Civil War tensions, the Republicans, basically every presidential election, would say, look, these guys, these Democrats are the ones who let slavery propagate across the country, and if you elect them, you're only going to let them undo all the gains we made in the Civil War. They'd wave the bloody shirt, it was called.
Oh.
You know, your sons will have died for nothing if the Democrats are allowed to come back into office. That mostly fell on deaf ears this time, especially because Winfield Scott Hancock was himself a war hero who had fought on the Union side.
Right.
So it's a little harder to go, like, you can't let this Union war hero into office. And the election would end up being mostly decided over tariffs. He made, like, kind of an anti-tariff statement at some point, and the Republicans at the time were just making a big deal of tariff protections to help American businesses.
Weren't we just doing that recently, too?
Yeah, some stuff just stays the same.
Jesus Christ.
So tariffs decided it, and the popular vote was split by 1,898 votes.
Oh my God.
The narrowest margin in history. He won the Electoral College by a little bit more, Garfield did. But it was a very narrow election. He also won the popular, yeah, okay. By less than 2,000 votes.
Wow.
To Charles Guiteau, it was unthinkable with such a narrow margin of victory. It's impossible that he was not directly responsible for the election of James Garfield. I mean, he must have reached at least 1,898 people.
Just by sheer force of annoyance alone.
Yeah, he delivered that speech maybe at most one other time besides at that Republican convention.
Yeah, but the pamphlets, Sean.
Which he distributed at a Republican event.
So people were already on his side.
But a cherry job of his choosing was surely coming Guiteau's way.
Mm-hmm.
And so, 9 days after the election, he wrote to the sitting Secretary of State. So from the previous administration, the current...
Because he clearly has no sense of anything.
William Evarts is the current Secretary of State. And he wrote,
Honorable Mr. Evart, Dear sir, I wish to ask you a question. If President Garfield appoint Mr. A, let's just call him Mr. A, to a foreign mission, does that supersede President Hayes' commission for the same appointment? Do not all foreign ministers appointed by President Hayes retire on March 4th next? Please answer me at the Fifth Ave Hotel at your earliest convenience. I am solid for General Garfield and may get an important appointment from him next spring. Yours very truly, Charles Guiteau.
Okay.
So with such confidence that he's reaching out to the current Secretary of State going like, hey, I just want to make sure like all of your guys will be cleared out of the way because I'm pretty sure I'm going to get
audacious.
Pretty sure I'm going to get some good news from President Garfield, if you know what I mean.
Wild.
After the minister to Austria did retire in March when Garfield was inaugurated, they used to do that in March, not January, Guiteau wrote to President Garfield himself, as well as Secretary of State James Blaine. I don't know who the actual addressee was on this, because the top of the paper says, to President Garfield and Secretary Blaine.
I hereby make a formal application for the Austrian mission. I feel I have a right to do it on account of my services during the canvass. Also, on account of having called General Garfield's attention to it just after the October elections, and in January, and also currently. I ask this as a personal tribute. I have asked no one to sign this application, but if it is necessary, I will ask some of our leading men to do it. So long as Mr. Kassen, that's the previous minister to Austria, wished to remain at Vienna, I had no disposition to disturb him. But now that he has resigned, I feel I have a right to press my claim. Imagine,
God, he's insufferable.
Imagine writing this letter to the President of the United States.
I have trouble enough asserting my authority and knowledge on things that I know that I am good at and can do.
Yeah, most of us can't ask for a small pay raise at work.
Yes.
A day off. Charles wants the whole damn thing.
Wow.
So over the next several months, it won't surprise you to hear that Guiteau was a fixture, a daily fixture at the White House, where job seekers would line up outside the door every day. And this is all because of this patronage system. Like, every destitute person who knows, or maybe even doesn't know the president, knows that he's going to give out a bunch of jobs, and they just think, maybe me?
Okay.
He would also show up at Secretary Blaine's office all the time, to the point where he started getting turned away by the security guards. Meanwhile, he was constantly bombarding Secretary Blaine with letters. First, these letters were asking for his endorsement for the Austria consulship we mentioned. And then he sent some letters saying, you know what, I've decided actually Austria, it sounds nice, but I think I'd rather live in Paris. So if I could have the Paris consulship instead, that would be great.
I deserve an even bigger post.
And then more letters saying, hey, listen, no more mention of Paris. Hey, listen, I think the president really likes me for that Austria job. So if there's anything you can do to help on your end.
The delusion is so wild.
Tell me if this is delusional or disturbing. He crashed a White House party at one point and introduced himself to First Lady Lucretia Garfield as one of the men that made Mr. Garfield president.
Well, knowing that he's going to kill him later, it's disturbing, yeah.
He probably didn't make a great impression on her.
No.
I don't know what he smelled like at this point. He had a scraggly beard, he did, and beady eyes. But Guiteau was also completely destitute at this point. Remember, he doesn't have a job. And he was moving between Washington boarding houses just like not paying the rent. Like he would sneak out the window in the early morning. And yeah, he owned a single suit.
Ugh.
Totally threadbare. He had no hat, coat, or boots. And this is still very much wintertime in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent his days just hanging around hotel lobbies, picking up newspapers off the ground or end tables or whatever, and trying to find the schedules of all of the president's, you know, advisors so he could bother them about these jobs.
It's sort of frightening how someone like this can just change the course of history.
Well, I think what's frightening is that no one has given him, no one at any point has given him encouragement. I mean, no one's encouraged Charles Guiteau about anything in his entire life, basically. Mm-hmm.
So he's used to it.
So he's used to it. But no one has encouraged him on this at all.
No one's given him any promises.
No one asked him for his help. No one said that he would be rewarded for his help.
But people like that exist, that they feel entitled to something just because they put in the minimum effort. It's like a guy who has been friend-zoned and is acting all incel because he feels like he should be slept with because he's been somewhat nice to a girl.
Starting in late March, basically every time Secretary Blaine, so James Blaine, remember he was one of the guys running for the nomination, one of the Republicans who wanted to run for president this time around.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one the half-breeds were supporting.
Mm-hmm.
He's the Secretary of State now. And almost every day by late March, when he showed up at work, Charles Guiteau would be waiting outside.
God, what a nightmare.
Asking if there were any news on those foreign posting jobs. And every time, Secretary Blaine would politely tell Charles, no, we haven't taken up the issue of consulates yet. Sorry. Until finally, after months of this, remember he started being almost a daily fixture at Blaine's office in late March. On May 14th, Guiteau asked again if there was anything new to report, and Blaine snapped, never speak to me again on the subject of the Paris consulate as long as you live.
So, but what about the Australian one?
No. Charles Guiteau had had enough of this ingratitude, and he stormed out of Blaine's office. I am going to see the president about this, he said on his way out the door. Guiteau indeed would write to President Garfield, reporting Blaine's behavior. And he was a little surprised he didn't get a reply from the president, but he wrote again, now demanding that the president dismiss Blaine, or you and your entire Republican Party will come to grief. There was still no answer to that letter, so Guiteau tried to drop by the White House to discuss the matter in person with the president, and he was told that he had been personally banned from the White House waiting room.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that, even for somebody as thick as Charles Guiteau, it was pretty clear that his political career was dead.
The final insult.
Yeah. And Guiteau came to what was to him the natural conclusion. He had obviously, his life had been spared for some greater purpose, right? We established that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And now he knew that that purpose must be, he was chosen by God to kill James Garfield.
Just because he didn't get what he wanted from him.
Basically, yes.
What a wiener.
Major wiener. And I think we're going to leave it there for this week, Caroline. We already saw where the story ends at the beginning of this show. But next week, Charles Guiteau will prepare himself to undertake that fateful task that he feels has been set before him by God. And we will go through the unfortunate, the tragic, really, death of James Garfield, and then the, the less tragic death of Charles Guiteau.
All right.
But what do you think so far?
I think this guy sucks. but I'm glad that at least I know a little bit more about Garfield, because he seems like he was a really well-rounded, genuinely good guy. I mean, it makes me sad. But, you know, it's sad that he's been sort of swept under the rug of history because of, you know, his tenure being cut short in this way and obviously being overshadowed by the fact that he was assassinated.
I also think between Lincoln, it's like Lincoln, Andrew Johnson, everyone knows was a bad president.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think people get pretty misty from after Johnson, which I think was Grant, but people get pretty misty from Johnson to, like, Teddy Roosevelt?
Yeah, I certainly do. I mean, I knew about Grant, yeah, but, like, who else is there? You know, Rutherford Hayes? Who?
Right.
Obviously, I know who they are, but I don't know, like, anything about their positions.
Chester A. Arthur, we just mentioned, is the vice president for
Garfield.
It's
a lot of guys that I imagine in my head sound like...
Oh, lots of sideburns.
Yep. A lot of mutton chops. A lot of eaten mutton chops.
And I think a big part of it is, A, like, yes, we all have a better sense of the 20th century presidents because...
Of course.
Because they... But that's because they did stuff that is still relevant. Stuff that echoes through... And of course... The stuff that Abraham Lincoln did still affects us today, but it's a little harder to see where those impacts are than, say, the presidents who won World War II for us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just, like, these guys had lots of political issues of the day to deal with, but none of them are things that we still talk about. So it's hard to even say what happened in the 4 years of Chester A. Arthur's presidency, which we'll touch briefly on next week.
All right.
But yeah, that will do it for now. And if the name Charles Guiteau sounds familiar to any of our listeners and they don't know where from, we did do an episode on famous last words that, it'll be a light spoiler, I guess, for this episode, for next week's episode, if you go back and listen to that. But yeah, Guiteau's last words leave an impression.
I'm sure they did.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for craveable, hand-battered, cooked-to-order chicken fingers.
Chicken up.
Crispy, crinkle-cut fries.
Hot potato coming through.
Buttery Texas toast.
Toast walking.
And secret Cane's sauce.
Stopping off now.
Turbocharge your chicken fingers and get them even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app.
Go, go, go!
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Let's take a trip to the Bizarre Bazaar.
Oh, it's been so long. The smell of incense filling my nose. I love visiting this bazaar.
In a surprising follow-up to our Mysterious Sounds episode, a town in Northern Ireland is currently under siege by a strange, unidentified hum, and local officials are stumped as to both the origin of the sound and how to make it stop.
Did someone leave their cell phone next to the mixer? Because when we get hum on the podcast, it's usually, someone left their cell phone next to the mixer.
Well, it's a long time to leave their cell phone, Sean. Residents of the town of Omagh in County Tyrone have been reporting a persistent low-level hum or buzz in the area since mid-October, so weeks now, about a month, when the annoying drone was first noticed. It seems to happen mostly at nighttime, around 10 p.m. until midnight, so this isn't necessarily a completely continuous hum. Local official Stephen Donnelly discussed the issue with the news. Quote, "For some people, it's something that they've gotten used to. For some people, they haven't heard it, but for a considerable number of people, it's something that's providing a disturbance that is giving real cause for concern."
Sorry, is it high-pitched or low-pitched?
It's a low-level hum or buzz. So, like, seems deep, a deep hum.
Well, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Of the fact that it mostly happens at a particular time of night, the counselor noted, quote, "It possibly is because of the fact that around that time traffic tends to be at its lowest point, and it then becomes a bit more audible and tangible, but that seems to be the issue." Donnelly added, "As time went by and people started to engage with me, it became clear that this was something that was infecting the entirety of the town, and the possibility is that it is seasonal. It's possibly related to weather, but I think the honest point at this stage is that we don't know the actual origin, and we have to be able to try and establish the facts first before we can secure a solution." So the town is now looking to bring in noise specialists to take a look, well, or a listen, I guess, at the problem. Quote, I requested that the council investigate the matter a number of weeks ago, and following that investigation, they've confirmed that there is a legitimate issue, particularly in the Kulnagard area of the terrain, said Donnelly.
Has anyone asked where about the whereabouts of the crash test dummies? Is it kind of a
I mean, it might be. From that point, they've not been able to identify the actual source or potential sources of the noise, but they have confirmed that it is there, and from this point going forward, they're going to have to procure additional specialist equipment to be able to properly zone in and identify where the noise is coming from. So hopefully the specialists will be able to figure out what the strange sound is and how to make it stop for the sake of the townsfolk's sanity.
Did they say whether there were like age related, like do young or old people hear it or not hear it?
No, at a certain point they thought it was just in one region, like southeast or something. But then they got notifications from like all over the area. So it's not just relegated to like one part, but the whole town.
So it's growing.
Possibly growing, or possibly they just hadn't gotten reports from that area yet. But yeah.
Great. Something to look forward to.
When we go to Ireland?
No, when it expands to reach us, then we're all just hearing a hum all the time.
Oh gosh, yeah. That would be terrible.
Crash test dummies.
That's it for this episode of Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Ain't It Scary, and check out our website at ainitscary.com. You can support the show by supporting our sponsors and becoming a patron at www.patreon.com/ain'titscary. You can call us and leave a message at our Google Voice number, 203-666-5529. And please subscribe to the show and throw us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and also on Spotify. We'll be forever grateful.
We certainly will. And special thanks to those of you already joining us on our top couple of Patreon tiers: Sean O'Donnell, Jared Chamberlain, Maria Ferrante, Robin McCabe, Comfy Mike, Alex Nakutis, Ryan Regan, Christy Atchison, Kate Pope, Haley, Ryan, Enrique, Ira, Pete, Anna, and Delaney. Thank you all so much, members of our spooky family.
And speaking of thanks, happy Thanksgiving to all of our American listeners. We'll see you next Thursday.
Show created by Sean and Carrie McCabe, music by Kyle Ryan. You can find Kyle at his YouTube channel, Music is a Verb.
Ain't It Scary has been brought to you by Killer Podcasts and is a production of Longboy Media.
Hi, I'm Matt Harris. Seton Tucker and I host the podcast Impact of Influence, which for 2 years covered in depth Alec Murdoch, who was eventually convicted in 2023 of murdering his wife Maggie and son Paul. That story continues to evolve, and we will cover that. Plus, we will tell you stories of other true crime events that have happened in the South. Please join us on Impact of Influence. And give us a follow on the Impact of Influence Facebook page.